Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen. This is the 17th right of October, 2012, 4 days before my 60th birthday, God help us. And I wanted to talk about, on the eve of my own personal birthday, with some reflections about the Buddha's teachings regarding love as a path of awakening. And you may know that in the history of Buddhism, there was a kind of reformation, if you will, in Buddhism around 5 or 6 centuries after the Buddha passed away, in which what's called the Mahayana developments really crystallized. They did so over actually a number of centuries, but they really took strong form, in part as Buddhism moved into Tibet, with the emphasis on the bodhisattva, the idea of postponing personal awakening for the sake of all beings until all beings are awakened, and emphasizing qualities of compassion or love amidst the emphasis on wisdom in the teachings of early Buddhism. So minimally, this, if you will, second wave, sometimes called the second turning of the wheel in Buddhism, that gave rise to Tibetan Buddhism and Zen, and then the fourth major wing of Buddhism, Pure Land Buddhism. The polite formulation of this is that this second turning involved hidden teachings of the Buddha that were not really, could not really be assimilated or understood by the people of his time. Or another way of understanding it is that it's a kind of gentle enhancement of the wisdom focus of early Buddhism. Or the harsher version of it is that the early teachings were the lesser vehicle, Hinayana. And Hinayana, Hina doesn't just mean smaller, it means more like meh, the meh vehicle that now is embodied in the Theravadin or Vipassana wing of Buddhism, which to me doesn't seem that meh at all. And recent scholarship, though, has shown that in the Buddha's own time, in his own teachings, which were given orally because there was no writing in India at the time of the Buddha, except for the tax records, essentially, of the you know, wealthy rajas and princes and so forth, because they knew on which side of the bread the butter was, you know, and they wanted to know who still owed them a few bushels of grain, as it were. But generally speaking, almost everything was done in an oral way in the Buddha's time. So there's some question, of course, about what he basically taught, but there's a lot of growing evidence, especially with recent scholarship. And if you like, I recommend a book called What the Buddha Thought by Richard Gombrich, who's the former Oxford muckety-muck professor of Sanskrit or something or other, a world-class scholar. And he and others have shown that in the Buddha's own time, he really did emphasize and speak to love, broadly defined, as a full path of practice all the way to awakening. And Gombrich's argument, and that of other scholars, is that if the Buddha had been properly understood in his own time, and especially during the few centuries immediately after his passing, if it had been appreciated how much he really did emphasize love as a path of practice, then there would not have been the need for this, second turning of the wheel to correct or purify the misunderstandings of the Buddha's followers in the centuries after his passing. So it's interesting to put what I'm about to talk about in historical perspective. So how might love, broadly defined, be a path to awakening? And I thought I could talk about this if you'll grant me the Kalyanamitta privilege of speaking quite personally from my own history. I want to talk about it in the frame of the Four Noble Truths. So as you recall or know, the Four Noble, or as it's increasingly translated, the Ennobling Truths. In other words, it is ennobling to face these truths and come to terms with these truths and increasingly give over to these truths and embody them in our own lives and to live from them. That's an ennobling practice. Well, as you know, those ennobling truths are the truth of suffering, not that all life is suffering, but that there is suffering, and frankly, a lot of it, particularly if you encompass the whole spectrum of suffering, from very subtle physical or mental discomfort all the way out to extreme agony. So there's the ennobling truth of suffering, the reality of suffering. The second ennobling truth is the recognition of a deep cause, if not the deep cause, of suffering, which is to say craving, clinging, drivenness, grasping of various kinds. And then there is the third ennobling truth, which is the truth of the end of the cause of suffering, which is the truth of cessation, where craving falls away and we engage life. We engage life. This is not an ascetic practice. The Buddha rejected that as being not a complete path to awakening and, in fact, obstructing full awakening. We engage life, though, on the basis of the third ennobling truth, with a mind that's free of craving. And then the fourth ennobling truth is the path leading to that utter falling away of craving, which is completed and fulfilled in the Buddhist frame in the fourth stage of awakening, the fourth stage of enlightenment. So how can we understand love in terms of these four ennobling truths? So I want to tell you a few stories from my own life about this. So first, the truth of suffering, the reality of suffering. How does love help us grasp this truth? The essence of the Buddhist path to awakening is to fully give over to these four ennobling truths. That's the essence of the path, to really understand them and to live from them and to have their consequences fully ripple forward in our body, our mind, and our actions. So my earliest memory, I think it's interesting to go back to your very first memory. And by the way, when I speak quite personally tonight, more personally than I believe I've ever done in any of these talks, perhaps any public talk, I invite you to look into your own experience, your own story, in terms of what you might find that overlaps with what I'm talking about. My very first memory, I was about 2.5, I was probably just shy of 3, and I was playing catch with my younger sister, who was 13 months younger, except we were playing catch with a red metal cup, which I remember vividly. And she was on the other side of one of those accordion devices that parents stretch across doorways to keep kids, you know, the zoo animals, as it were, you know, keep the lions away from the tigers or bears or whatever. So I was on one side. She flipped it. I lunged for it. And we had a very heavy bed with a metal support for the mattress and with springs in it, you know. So I lunged for the glass. I see the frame of the bed. And the next thing I see is my mother standing tall, you know, from the perspective of a little kid, there in the doorway on the other side of the accordion, looking at me with enormous alarm because I had split my forehead open. And, you know, a head wound, even if it's not lethal, is very bloody. It's very dramatic. And my mother, very loving. She was, totally freaked out. And, of course, you can imagine her position. She had to immediately figure out, what do I do with my one-year-old? I got this kid with blood pouring down his face. My husband's away working. You know, my dad was working as a, he was probably at that point a postdoc, you know, and working for the Fish and Game Department as a zoologist. And, you know, so that's her. And then the next thing I know, I'm in a car rushing apparently to the hospital to get some stitches. And here's the essence of the memory, which is very vivid for me. I'm sitting in the car. I've got a container of ice, one of those old-fashioned metal containers with the thing you flip up. I see that. It's there. I'm sitting in this car. I know from memory is the old Plymouth my parents had. Plymouth, that really dates us. This is like 1954, maybe 55, when this is all happening. And I'm holding the ice with Kleenex. The Kleenex is shredding around the ice as I hold it to my forehead. My mom tells me to do that. And I'm watching her drive. And here's the essence of the memory. I'm feeling really pretty calm. Like, and I'm feeling reassuring toward her. I love my mother, right? For lots of reasons, including that she's no longer alive, but deeply lovable. And, you know, I'm a little kid. I love my mom. And she's so upset. You know, she's stressed. She's rattled. She loves me. She's worried. I'm her precious child. I learned much later, you know, that she had several miscarriages before I came along. I was a very wanted child. And they were thinking of adopting before they, you know, got pregnant with me. And, of course, they didn't get pregnant. I mean, that's a joke. My mother got pregnant. You know, I love couples where they say, we're pregnant. What we, man? You know what I mean? It's the woman who's pregnant. But anyway, but there I was. I had this sense of love for my mother, which connected me with her suffering. I recognize her suffering. Love recognizes suffering. Love helps us recognize the ennobling truth of suffering. That's what was central for me in the car. I was okay, you know? It was kind of fun, actually. You know, ice, drama, special. You know, it's kind of really okay, but what was there for me mostly was just a lot of calm, inner peace, and concern and sympathy for my mother's upset. And then another story I want to tell about the second noble truth, the truth of craving. This one's not for me directly. There are two stories here quickly. One is I'm seeing a client now who's in a relationship with a man who's clearly a good man, good heart, very principled, very honorable, and he loves my client so much that he's squeezing the life out of the relationship. This is the second noble truth of craving and clinging, you know, the negative aspects of attachment. And one power of love is to show us, because it's only this far away from clutching, clinging. You know, the little child clutching to the parent's leg, you know, suffering madly, deeping, a cause of suffering, jealousy, possessiveness, envy, you know, the longing to be special to others. How beautiful and fine that is at its center, and how easy it is to tip away from that center into very, very painful, you know, grabbing, gotta, must, and so forth. And we can see this with this man. He is too fixated on holding on to this relationship. He's getting too possessive, too controlling, in a way that many different kinds of people do. And there's a long history in patriarchy of men in particular doing, and she's having none of it, and that's going to be the end of the relationship. So love teaches us that we have to be careful, that we are engaged in life, but we're playing with fire, and we have to have our eyes on the process and not tip into, and not tip from liking to wanting, from enjoying to clutching. A variation on that for myself is with my children, our children. My wife and I have two kids, they're young adults now. I love my kids dearly. When they were younger, one way I expressed that love is that I wanted to help them, right? And I would get invested in various things, how they were doing in school, how their friendships were going, how their mind was evolving. And sometimes I was centered, I was okay, I didn't tip into trouble, but I definitely tipped into trouble. You know, my own need for them to turn out well or, you know, do well in school or have friends or, you know, learn how to ride a bike led me to act in some pretty inappropriate ways. Not horrible, evil dad, crazy ways, but definitely consequential, creating suffering. You know, I lived in, my love tipped too far into the craving that leads to suffering. And that right there is an incredible lesson. Then there's the third noble truth, the ennobling truth of letting go, of not clinging. And how do we engage life in that way? And I have two stories about that. Both involve romantic love. The first story is that I lived in Finland in late 67 through 68 with my family. I was 14 when I arrived and 15 by the springtime. And my father's a professor. He went there on a grant. My whole family went, my younger sister and then really younger brother. I went to a Swedish boys' school. I learned decent Swedish there. And in the early springtime in Finland, they have a custom that relates to the thawing of the river in the spring and so forth, where the boys from this Swedish boys' school and the girls from the Swedish girls' school have a big dance, okay? And my friends in the Swedish boys' school asked me if they could set me up with this girl. And you have to know who I was then. Maybe you can see more than a few vestiges of that fellow now. Enormously shy, nerdy, awkward, skinny, bespectacled, no social skills whatsoever, no game whatsoever in the relationship department. Like, oh my God. But for some reason I said, sure, you know, when you're in a foreign country, nobody knows you, you can kind of be whoever you want to be in a sense. You can break free. So I said, fine. Anyway, so I met her, and her name, Christina Blomqvist. And she was 17. I skipped a grade. I was real young going through school. And I had a very late birthday. But it was cool. We connected. And to fast forward through a lot of details, we really clicked. She had fluent English, fantastic person. We just really connected. This particular relationship completely changed my life in many, many kinds of ways. And the point of my story that I'm getting to in the context of the third ennobling truth, the non-attachment, the way that love helps us let go and teaches us about letting go, is that about a month before I knew we were going to leave, because inevitably my family would leave. And when you're 15, you're leaving. And she's 17, she's staying. That you just know that's where it's going to go. And meanwhile, I was falling for her more and more and more deeply. What do we do then? You know, do we stop because we want to prevent some pain, or do we let go? Do we love without fear, as it were? And through grace or whatever, I found myself just completely falling in love, really, for the very first time in my life. And now, having fallen in love a couple of times since then, I have complete respect for where the realness and the maturity and the genuineness. It wasn't puppy love, you know, it was real love. So it came to me that I needed to tell her I loved her. And that was the most frightening thing probably I've ever done in my entire life. And I've done a lot of serious rock climbing. I've been in situations where I'm 100 feet off, you know, above my protection. If I fall, I'll die. And the wind is whistling, and it's not easy, but I got to keep going. You know, I've been in places like that. But this was even scarier. And so to have the courage, to find the courage that in which love basically carried me into this letting go, whatever, I've got to speak the truth. I've got to tell her I love her. And I did. I remember exactly where and when it was on this high ridge. And, you know, I kind of really nerved myself to do it. And then she blew my mind by telling me she loved me too. And then we just really gave ourselves to it. There was just a month, and I knew we were going to go. I've never seen her since. We wrote to each other for many, many years that we lost that connection. Out of the blue, a few years ago, she reconnected because she found stuff I had written about mothers, because my first book was about mothers, and she works in parent education there still in Finland. And, you know, there's a friendship there. You know, that boat has long sailed. I've been married happily for 30 years. But what was there then with Christina was completely true. And love took me into this letting go, letting go, letting go. The fourth noble truth is the path leading to the end of craving, you know. And in the essence of it, even though there are eight elements, they're really boiled down to three. The three are the three pillars of practice in Buddhism. In Pali, the language of early Buddhism, and you see these same three pillars in Christian contemplative practice too, which is really interesting. Because there's only one human brain, and if there is, there's obviously only one divine. So the three pillars of practice in Buddhism, the words are sila, samadhi, and panya. Sila is virtue, restraint, non-harming. Samadhi is steadiness, concentration, purification of mind. And panya is wisdom. Seeing things, seeing the truth of things, being in the truth. Well, if you think about it, love supports all three. In the first case, with regard to virtue, which is really foundational, again and again and again, the Buddha emphasized virtue. As Buddhism has moved to the West, there's been a real emphasis on the cool, super-powered esoteric teachings. And as many have pointed out, we need to emphasize the ethical aspects, the moral, the virtuous aspects of practice too. Well, the essence of love is non-harming. That's where the great teachings on compassion, kindness come in, including not harming oneself. I remember really vividly, again, another story. I was driving to work, and the way my house is, you go up the street, you turn around, and you come back down the other side. And when our daughter was about 9 or so, as I was going down the street headed toward work, probably going a little too fast in a residential neighborhood, but I live there all the time, probably going at least 30 miles an hour, she raced out across the median between our house and then the side of the street I was on, and kind of raced to the edge of the curb toward me, and maybe took a step over just as I was coming toward her. Freaked me out as a parent, really scared me. I stopped the car. She was just happy. She wanted to tell her daddy, Laurel and I were very tight, something, and I overreacted, I was too harsh. My tone was too intense. I was upset that she could get hurt, but still, I overreacted. I scolded her, and I can still see her face to this day, and many times, because I do it typically at least once a day, if not more often, I drive down the street to work or, to the store or something like that, and as I pass that particular tree or spot, I wince internally at the harm I did her, right? Well, love helps me not harm her anymore. We can't do anything about the past, right? The harms are the harms. But we can learn from the past without overdoing it about the past so that we know in our heart we'll never do that again. And then we're free of the past. We really know I'm not going to do that ever again. I got it. I may still have to deal with the consequences of that, but I know in my heart is pure in this regard. I'm not ever going to do that again. And, you walk your talk and you watch and you go, I don't do that again. So we don't want to harm others if we care about them. And so many of the Buddhist teachings are about that, including quite, very dramatic examples where he says basically, even if bandits are sawing you limb from limb, you should not drop your loving kindness for them. You may feel great pain. You may think they belong in jail. You may wish for an army to come in and protect you, but you still do not put them out of your heart. The other aspect of non-harming is to not harm ourselves. And that, too, is an aspect of sila, of restraint, of virtue and morality. And, when you realize, for example, that anger against others is an affliction upon yourself, it reframes anger. Getting irritable or exasperated or sparky or snappish or tart in our tone toward others is an affliction on ourselves. Needless worry is an affliction upon oneself. Kind of just hanging out in a sense of the blues long past its, sell-by date, right? That's a kind of affliction on the self. So if we really want to practice non-harming toward all beings, and the Buddha made it clear, it's not everyone but you. That's negative grandiosity. I'm so special that I'm the one person who doesn't deserve the dispensation. No, it's toward all beings, including the one who wears your name tag. If we practice non-harming, a major way to look at non-harming, and there are others as well, obviously, not using intoxicants to the point of harm, not overdoing things in life, taking care of the body. When you turn 60 or approach 60, you start thinking more and more about that kind of thing. But especially emotional harming. I'm really asking, what are the ways I harm myself emotionally? And if I really lived from love, if I really lived from compassion and good wishes toward other beings, toward beings including this being, would I activate those emotional patterns in the same way? Or if they start getting activated, and they do, do I need to keep fueling them? We can't control the fire that ignites often. It's happening. Long term we can, right? But in the moment we're ignited. But do we have to keep adding fuel, logs, coal, briquettes, gasoline to the fires of our own afflictions. Then there's the teaching of Panya, the third, the second pillar of practice, if you will, the one that has to do with insight and understanding. And it's interesting that as we ground in love, for one, it really takes us out into a sense of connectedness, which is the truth of everything. The essence of Buddha Dharma is everything changes, and everything's connected to everything else. And if we align with that truth, we are happy and we don't harm others or ourselves. And if we resist that truth, we create suffering and harm for ourselves and others. Love takes us right out into that. You know, love enables us to allow things to continually change without trying to cling to them and reify them and stabilize them and keep them. And love also teaches us that we really are deeply interconnected with all life, with other people, with our friends, our family, our Kalyanamita, our spiritual friends, and out wide into the whole world. The other thing, I was reflecting on this during the meditation, is that if you think about it, if there was something or someone who utterly supported you, who fed you moment to moment and kept you alive, who gave you the conditions moment to moment of happiness and love and peace and wisdom, you would feel deeply loved by that one, wouldn't you? That sounds like great mothering, great fathering, you know, great mating, great loving. Well, if you think about it, that's actually the nature of reality. Reality altogether, in each moment, is supporting us, carrying us, enabling us, giving everything we want. We're buoyed moment to moment, including in ways that are mysterious, at least to the scientists, maybe not to the mystics. But we are buoyed moment to moment by some kind of thin skin of reality that keeps disappearing moment to moment, that seems to rest on something unconditioned, in the Buddha's language, deathless, the mystery, beyond all words, the realm of Nibbana, Nirvana. That's our state right now. Our bodies, the breath, the air, everything. Reality, we are in reality. Just at the most elemental level, reality is carrying us, caressing us, feeding us, protecting us, nurturing us, like the greatest mother that ever was. Right under our noses, moment to moment. That's a profound opportunity to see the truth of things and how profoundly, in a sense, loved we are by reality. That may sound kind of cosmic and out there, but if you think about it, it's exactly right here. It's our exact condition right now. And, you know, love can take us into that wisdom too. And then the last pillar of the Eightfold Path with regard to love is the one about concentration. And concentration has two meanings. One meaning is the steadiness of mind. The other meaning is as like a fine balsamic vinegar or port wine or chocolate sauce or something. It's concentrated. In other words, that which is not it has gradually been, you know, separated out and taken away. And there's a line from A Course in Miracles, which for me is just this amazing collection of wisdom. It's just mind-blowing, actually, how profound it is, really, I think, in many, many places throughout. Anyway, there's this quote, to paraphrase, it's something like, love surfaces everything that is not itself to be purified. That's the nature of love. Well, the nature of love, therefore, is, in a sense, to concentrate itself increasingly as love and nothing but love. And that takes me toward the end of just my little talk here to two fundamental aspects of this process of purification. One is, as people have taught in Buddhism, to see all beings as Buddha. That is not a cliche. We can take it as this sentimental Hallmark card kind of notion. But to actually engage it, you know, to walk down the street and to see strangers as Buddha, to look at the people that are aggravating you as Buddha, yeah, in some way, you know, as having Buddha nature in some way. You know, their personality is maybe aggravating, maybe harmful, may not like their politics, may not like what they're saying in the moment, or how they cut us off in the freeway or crowded us out in line, what have you. But first, I don't know about you, but I think each one of us is able to either listen into another or imagine another or look through their eyes to the being as process behind their eyes and see something beautiful and pure in every person. They may behave in terrible ways, but behind that behavior, I think each one of us has the capability of seeing in any other person something that's really beautiful. You know, the longing for truth, the longing for real happiness, the longing for peace that we can discern in the other person as one way to recognize their Buddha nature, if you will, their elemental, essential purity and goodness, deep, deep down, behind the obscurations, as they would say in Tibet, behind the veils and yet shining through. Additionally, when we look at other people, we can recognize their nature in a very deep way as our own nature, which is to say a transient modification of the unconditioned. And if that's what we understand Buddha nature to be, Buddha nature is the unconditioned. Buddha nature is the nature of nature, if you will. It's the deepest realm of possibility, of emergent, liberated possibility. And we see that they, like us, we all have the same deep nature in this profound sense. And we can see that quality in other people. And love, man, oh man, love helps us see that quality in other people, doesn't it? Like nothing else. It helps us see past our momentary reactivation, helps us see past the momentary problematic qualities in their behavior or words or attitudes or tone, to, you know, this fundamental Buddha nature in either of these two senses in the other person. Love takes us there. And taking us there, we're increasingly liberated of our own issues, our own hassles, our own sense of self. And then the last way in which love takes us into this kind of purification that I want to talk about is, I think, in many ways, one of the hardest steps of all, especially perhaps for people in the West, which is to actually claim and know your own profoundly loving nature. To actually admit it to yourself and actually surrender to the implications, you know, to actually let go into, wow, I really am a loving person. When I give over to love, it feels increasingly inexhaustible. When I open the faucet, it doesn't run out. It actually starts coming more and more strongly, kind of blows the faucet wide open. Now it's the pipe. Next thing I know, it's the whole Pacific Ocean flowing through. That's really my nature. You know, the real fear, I think, is we're afraid of the implications. If I really gave over to the love in me, that doesn't mean waiving my rights, doesn't mean being a doorman, but if I really gave over to this incredible current that I can feel dammed up inside me, it would blow wide open my personality. It would blow open my contracted little self. I couldn't run my typical number. I'd have to give up about it and give over to something else. And yet, if we, you know, do recognize that love and we have that sense of that spark inside ourselves, as we give ourselves over more and more to this, it's enormously fulfilling and rewarding. It's so happy. It feels so good. Love purifies everything that's not it. You know, life gets increasingly simple. It's really, have you ever noticed how hard it is to mistreat someone who's really loving? You know, like Mr. Rogers is kind of an icon for me. I don't know if you saw this thing I sent out recently as a clip of him at his Emmy Lifetime Achievement Award. And what he did in it is he asked all these superstars, who are all made up and all dolled up and totally work in the game of image and image management. He says, for 10 seconds, how about you just think about someone who's really loved you? And the whole room just stops. And he says in that wonderful Mr. Rogers way, don't worry, I'll keep the time. So they knew it was going to be 10 seconds, not 8 or 9, 10. And the whole room changed. Bam, 10 seconds, the room completely changed. So you think about Mr. Rogers. Who could hassle Mr. Rogers? You know what I mean? There are you couldn't do it. So again, as we give over to love ourselves, we feel increasingly carried by it. It's increasingly fulfilling. We have less and less basis for craving because we feel profoundly that our needs are met. And we feel at the end of it all that we're increasingly transparent. I mean, who needs to be a self? Who needs to be an ego when you're awash in love, connected to everything and buoyed along moment to moment by a reality that caresses, soothes, and feeds you every second of every day? I know this is true about you. And with the power invested in me on my eve of my 60th birthday, I really hope that I've convinced you. So let's sit for a minute or so. Let it sink in and we'll wrap up. Thank you for your attention and your practice. Take care. Thank you. I'll be 60 when I see you next week.